Okay, let's go. I don't promise to be my usual enthusiastic self, but I'll do the best that I can. All right, so we talked about ligaments. I talked a whole lot last week about, you know, mobility for stability, and how the ligaments play an important role in the shoulder, and the muscles help stabilize the shoulder, as do the ligaments as well. But, you know, the innate nature of the glenohumeral joint allows for this massive range of motion as compared, say, to the hip joint, which is the other ball and socket. So we talked a bit about the coracoacromial arch. And we have to understand this. I'm going to go back to it again. There's actually a student in the program who's having some issues with a supraspinatus tear. We'll get the supraspinatus muscle shortly. But this coracoacromial arch that's formed by the acromion and then the coracoacromial ligament. There is a bursa under here, which I'll talk about in a moment. But, you know, there's muscles that travel under here, specifically supraspinatus in identification. And this space is actually quite narrow. And as I said last week, one of the things you're going to learn about is the impingement degrees. When someone's got a shoulder problem, their inability to go through full abduction because everything jams up in this coracoacromial arch. It's kind of clinically important to get the sense of it. I've had, as you know, I've had a couple of shoulder repairs done because I had torn both my supraspinatus muscles and I had to have them reset back into the head of the humerus through surgery. Well, one thing that they do, because the scar tissue that can occur in here and because of the narrowness of this arch is its relationship to the top of the humerus and the tendon of the muscle, I actually had a bursectomy. They always remove the subacromial bursa and throw it away. So there's enough space in there that you don't get any more sort of, shall we say, friction on that tendon as it goes through. So it's one of the things they do when you have the surgery is to remove that bursa, to open up that space. Because again, when artists draw these sorts of things in the book, they look abundantly spacious. But anatomically, when you look at the real structures, they're not spacious at all. They get very, very tight. So any kind of, bursitis, any kind of tendonitis, it doesn't even have to be a tear at all. It just has to be any kind of inflammation, again, to tendon or to bursa. The space is so narrow that you just get irritation, it becomes a problem. You're going to see a lot of people with shoulder impingement issues just because of the kind of work that they do and the movements that they do. So you're going to come across it a lot clinically. As I said, you know, because of this range of motion of the shoulder, there had to be modifications to the capsule because the capsule has to allow for that range of motion. So, you know, we have this sort of twist that occurs in the capsule, and it untwists and gets tension on it as it moves through abduction. So anything that affects that is going to limit the movement as well. So we say the influence is that twisting increases the arm swings into abduction, tension increases, which causes the capsule to pull the humerus around into external rotation, and this allows untwisting to occur more, and then you get the full range. So it's something to keep in mind when you're looking at limited range in the GH joint. Now, as I said, I just talked about the subacromial bursa. We have a lot of structures that cross the GH joint, superiorly, anteriorly, posteriorly, and inferiorly. So, of course, when we have ligaments and or tendons that cross over joints, we have to have bursae. Some of them are communicating and some of them are non-communicating. Do you remember what that means? We didn't talk about it much because it doesn't really relate much to the axial skeleton. So what lies below the fibrous capsule, directly below? Synovial membrane. So sometimes what the body does, it allows the synovial membrane to pop out and form a bursa. So you have apertures in the fibrous capsule where the bursa, or where the synovial membrane comes out and forms a bursa underneath a structure. Other times you have a bursa that is completely unrelated to the joint itself and it kind of stands all alone. So if it's a communicating bursa, it actually is an extension of the synovial membrane. And one we've already talked about is the one, did we talk? Yeah, about the synovial sheath around long head biceps as it's coming through the intertrabecular groove, right? We talked a bit about that. That's considered in some way kind of a communicating bursa, because it is an extension of the actual synovial membrane of the GH joint that runs down through the intertrabecular groove. But they're either communicating or non-communicating. So the subacromio-subdeltoid can be called either or because of where it sits. It's located over supraspinatus and beneath the acromion and the deltoid muscle. So this doesn't lie underneath supraspinatus. This lies above it. So you've got the acromial arch that's the roof over top of supraspinatus. And between supraspinatus and the arch is where you find the subdeltoid subacromial bursa. It sits above. So you can see it right here. So here is oh, for Christ's sakes, Brian, your rotator cuff. And you can see here, supraspinatus here. Infraspinatus is here, and you can see the space between the acromial arch here with the tendon, or sorry, the ligament and the bone. You can see that the bursa is here, and you can see it's non-communicating because it's just sitting in there by itself, filling up the space. And again, it's preventing any kind of friction that can occur superiorly between the acromion and the supraspinatus tendon. It does not communicate with the joint capsule. It facilitates movement of the deltoid over the fibrous capsule and supraspinatus tendon, and it is susceptible to impingement if inflamed or swollen. So because it sits between the tendon and the bone, if it's inflamed and swollen, then in that abduction, it gets jammed between the humeral head and the acromion and gets irritated even further. So it's interesting. There's a lot of diagnosis with physicians around this bursa being inflamed. I sometimes question if it truly is the cause. A lot of the times, you know, they'll say, "Oh, I have a shoulder bursitis," and I've often found quite often that diagnosis kind of comes from a physician who goes, "Well, you got shoulder pain, but I'm not quite sure what's happening there." Right? I know when I had my shoulder was at its worst. Well, the first one. I can remember I got treated 100 different ways and finally went to a sports medicine guy who said, "You need an MRI." And I had an MRI, and within a week I knew exactly that I was going in for surgery because it was completely torn. But, you know, the family doctor was doing whatever. By the way, all the tests you're going to learn and assessments for the shoulder, the majority of them, don't do what they're supposed to do. You guys got McGee's? Have you started looking at McGee's yet? The assessment text? You notice, have you used it at all? Okay, you'll find that there's red, green, and yellow for tests. Red meaning they discovered that it's not a great test because it doesn't really do what it's supposed to do. And green means that it does. The majority of shoulder tests that you do don't, in fact, actually challenge the structures they say that they're supposed to challenge. But the CMTO still challenges you with those in your OPs. So we have to teach them to you. Even though the research says, don't do them. We'll discuss those a lot more when you get there. So you can see in this picture, it's much nicer. The humeral head's been removed. This is actually a long head biceps here. Okay, and here is you can see just how tight it is. There is your subacromial bursa here, and it sits very, very tightly, and right there is your supraspinatus tendon. So you can see just how tight it really is. There's not a lot of room for things to move in there, especially if that bursa gets sore or gets inflamed, as well as the tendon for supraspinatus. The subscapular bursa is between the tendon of subscapularis and the neck of the scapula. It communicates with the cavity of the shoulder joint through an opening in the fibrous capsule. So we say it's usually an extension of the synovial membrane, so it is a communicating bursa. So here we've got the tendon sheath here around long head biceps, which is considered kind of an elongated bursa that's communicating. You have a subscapular bursa here that is also a communicating. Your subacromial subdeltoid bursa is up here. So the potential for pain patterns and bursitis is quite high in the shoulder. There are nine others. You don't really need to know them per se, because at the end of the day, if they have a bursitis, and you treat it accordingly. When I went to school, if you had a bursitis or a tendonitis, you had to treat them all differently. So we'd go to our theory classes, and they would say, today we're going to do Achilles tendonitis. And you go back next week. This week we're going to do longhead biceps tendonitis. And it was the same treatment. So if you'll notice now, we don't use tendonitis too often anymore. We use the term tendinopathies, which sort of encapsulates anything that's an inflammation of a tendon. So, all right, here we go. Muscles. You didn't really start palpating those last week, did you? I heard Sarah was quite happy that you actually taken the appropriate anatomy for her lab. I know, I've already talked to her. Okay, so when we're looking at muscles of the shoulder girdle, we did last semester talk a little bit about upper trapezius and its relationship to the C-spine. We're now going to be discussing the middle to lower fibers of it. We have serratus anterior, we have our rhomboids, levator scapula, and so forth. So trapezius, as I said, we did discuss last semester the upper fibers and its relationship to the cervical spine. Trapezius is called trapezius because they feel that it is trapezoid shaped. It is one of the largest muscles in the human body, and it sort of covers a very broad expanse of that upper thoracic cage all the way to the C-spine. So its upper fibers arise from the external occipital protuberance, the medial one-third of the superior nuchal line of the occiput, the nuchal ligament and the spinous process of C7, to the lateral one-third of the clavicle and the acromion process. What just happened there? Where did it go? So it's up here, and then as it comes out to the shoulder, it goes around the shoulder. So if you take a hand and go around the shoulder in this configuration, that represents where it attaches. So if I go like this, that's where it comes from. So it comes all the way down, around, across the acromion, onto the scapula, onto the clavicle. So it's relatively wraps around and comes all the way around. So again, the external occipital protuberance, medial one-third of the superior nuchal line of the occiput, nuchal ligament and the spinous process of C7, to the lateral one-third of the clavicle and the acromion process. So think about that. That's quite a ways to wrap around. The middle fibers arise from the spinous processes of T1 to T5 to the acromion process and the spine of the scapula. So now instead of the clavicle, we're at the spine of the scapula. And the lower fibers arise from the tubercle at the root of the spine to the spinous processes of T6 to T12. Ultimately, this muscle runs from the external occipital protuberance all the way to T12. It's a big muscle. Now, because it's so large, it does a lot of stuff. So the upper fibers elevate the scapula. SCC joint is a scapulothoracic articulation. Okay, that's what I use this term. I don't like it, but he uses it in the book, so that way when you look in the textbook and you're studying, it'll say the same thing. So it elevates the scapula, retracts the scapula, and upwardly rotates the scapula, which is all of these are its primary action. The middle fibers retract the scapula at the scapulothoracic articulation, and the lower fibers depress the scapula, retract the scapula, and upwardly rotate the scapula. So ultimately, yes. No, it is. When you look at the spine, it's right where the spine arises on the medial border of the scapula itself. Okay? So all the movements that we know need to occur at the scapula for the GH joint to function properly. Many of those actions are the result of trapezius doing its influence on the scapula itself. Now, this muscle also has significant reverse motor actions as well. if we remember from last semester, a reverse motor action is when the distal attachment is inhibited or stabilized, and there's a reverse movement. So everything we've seen here affects the scapula. If the scapula is fixated, then what happens is upper trapezius extends the neck at the cervical spinal joints and the head at the atlanto-occipital joint when it's working bilaterally. Extends the neck and the head. Why does it do both? How can it extend the head? Because it crosses the joint of C1 and the condyles of the occiput, right? Okay. Upper trapezius contralaterally rotates the neck at the spinal joint and the head at the atlanto-occipital joint. Make sense? Because of the attachment. Middle and lower trapezius contralaterally rotate the trunk at the spinal joints if the scapula is fixed. So there's some rotation at the trunk. And lower fibers will extend at the thoracic spinal joints if the scapula is fixed. So you'll get those. Okay? So everything in primary action is the scapula and all its movements that it's required to do for the functioning of the GH joint. But if we fix the scapula, it affects the joints of the spine and the head, depending on which of the three sections you're looking at. And as I said, we did discuss the upper fibers last semester. It's innervation. It's interesting. Oh, crap. I didn't, because I was ill. Did anybody bring their books? You didn't bring your books, did you? Okay. Kendall and your Merles. You have your Merles, but nobody brought their Kendall? I just realized it. Sorry. It's a unique muscle because it has a cranial nerve innervation and a spinal nerve innervation. Upper trapezius, the upper fibers, basically, are cranial nerve 11. The test for cranial nerve 11 is resisted shoulder elevation. Okay? If one side's affected more than the other, you'll note weakness on resisted elevation, which represents cranial nerve 11. And all the rest of the muscle is C3 with the majority at C4 in terms of it. All right. I'll be right back. I'll get my Kindle and then I can read it to you. I might want to turn this off. Eh? I did that once, right? Okay. So, strength test, they say 329. Okay, so who would like to volunteer to lay on a table? I should start bringing a massage table with me. I may remember to do that. So let's think of fiber direction. What do we got here for fiber direction? Upper fibers will be what? Upper fibers are obliquely superior. Middle fibers will be transverse. Lower fibers will be inferiorly oblique, right? On your tummy. So, for middle trapezius, Kendall talks about how prone is the position of stability for the patient. So the nice thing with muscle testing and a lot of upper limb stuff, just the fact that the patient is lying down on a table already does the stabilization for you. Occasionally in upper limb, you do have to stabilize the GH joint or arm or elbow or something to be able to do it appropriately. The test is adduction and upward rotation of the scapula without elevation of the shoulder girdle. So think about that. Adduction and upward rotation of the scapula. So what's adduction of the scapula? What would be the other name for that? Correct. Retraction, right. It'd be retraction. In the test position is obtained by placing the shoulder in 90 degrees of abduction and in external rotation sufficient to bring the scapula into upward rotation. So, we've got 90 degrees, okay? We've got 90 degrees here. Just let your arm relax. What do I need to do? I need to do external rotation. So, relax. I don't want any shoulder elevation. I want you to bring your thumb up towards the ceiling. Bring it, and there's the rotation, okay? So, I get the rotation. Pressure is against the distal forearm in a downward direction towards the table. Now, I would stabilize this side because if I'm going to push, I don't want any rocking and rolling of his upper thorax. So, 90 degrees, rotation enough, bring the scapula, actually return rotation to bring the scapula into a bit of rotation. I stabilize, I'm going to push down, you're going to hold, okay? It's a bit weak. For a guy who goes to the gym all the time. Now, you're all going to find this. You're going to find this in every one of you. Even guys and gals who go to the gym and pound the weights. That you're going to find weakness, shockingly, in muscles that you didn't expect. I think I told you the classic story of the guy that hurt his shoulder. And he was he's on the true team in the OPP. You know what the true team is? It's kind of like the SWAT team. A big muscular guy, you know, Mr. Testosterone on two legs, right? And he hurt his shoulder, and I gave him a 2-pound weight, little tiny dumbbell, right? And he's like, "You got to be kidding! You couldn't do it." Once I got him in the position and I isolated the muscle that was the problem, it was the problem, and he was shocked that he couldn't do a 2-pound weight. So what happens is when you're lifting weights, even though you try to isolate when you're in the gym and you're lifting weights, you can't purely isolate. We, through these kind of positions, can purely isolate. So if this is the position for testing and I identify that it's weak, then this is the position for strengthening. Right. Everybody get that? Okay. Always remember that. Whatever the positions are that you're doing to test the muscle, and you find out that that muscle is weak or tight or whatever, this is the position you'd work in, okay? So let's try this side, okay? So you're externally rotated. You're going to resist me, okay? Crazy, eh? Okay? So his middle fibers are weak. How do you do seated row?
I usually do T-bar row.
What's that?
Oh,
so yeah, you go over and do this?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so a proper, to work upper middle trapezius and rhomboids, a proper row is shoulder retraction before you come forward. So the movement should be like this. Boom, then boom. And if you do it right, you cannot go beyond the scapula itself. So you'll see individuals doing this seated row and they're able to bring the bar to the chest. then they're not doing it right. If you retract your shoulder blades, your scapulas as tight as possible, you can't get much farther than that. And if you are, then you're using posterior deltoids and something else. In fact, I did that hard enough, I got a bit of a cramp. Okay, so it's retraction and then the row, right? So maybe you're just not doing it well enough, okay? Oh, did you? Okay. Okay, he's making excuses now. Okay, now lower trapezius, okay, is adduction, depression, and upward rotation of the scapula. The upper extremity is placed diagonally overhead in line with the lower fibers of the trapezius. That's why it's important to understand the fibers. So we've got this, this, and this, correct? So because lower fibers are here, I need to bring him here, then do the rotation. Okay, now you're going to resist me. Okay. All right. Okay. Because, you know, the honest thing is, though, the lower fibers, like seated rowing, that kind of stuff, doesn't really do lower fibers. It's more middle and rhomboids, those sorts of things. So how would you train lower fibers? Pull down or wide grip, pull up, right? So these. Now, again, when you see these in the gym, how do you appropriately do wide grip pull-ups? Or how do you do wide grip pull-downs? Right? Rotate, but you also go into extension and you present your upper chest to the bar. I see this far too often in the gym, right? This? No. You bring your chest to the bar. And again, if you're doing it right, you can't go any further than that if you're doing it correctly. Okay? And again, what you should be doing is concentrating on the muscles you're working is doing the pulling for you. Okay? So that's kind of important. All right? Everybody get it? So that's why you're going to bring the book, because we're going to be kind of doing that all the time. I think I'll bring a massage table in. Thanks, Logan. Now he's all depressed. Okay. So, stretch, strengthen. We'll see in a moment. So here we go. We've got, you can see all the movements that are occurring here. You can also see the fiber directions that are occurring here. And you can see, because of these fiber directions, the multitude of influences it has on the movement of the scapula in relationship to any kind of glenohumeral joint movement. So stretch can be, obviously, upper trapezius, if you're working bilaterally, is just quite simply head and cervical flexion. You can do a couple of different things here for stretching. Everybody kind of knows this one for upper trapezius, right? This is, you can grab a door frame or something. And again, no different than when I tested Logan lower. If I want to stretch lower, I've got to get that arm up into the fibers equal to the same fiber direction of lower and then pull accordingly. Okay? Strengthening. Your middle fibers, you can do this. So Musculino suggests weight held in the right hand. Traction force protracts the scapula. Medially rotating the right arm enhances the stretch. So just using a weight to hold that down and then medial rotation will stretch a little bit more as far as that goes. Okay. Upper fibers, the classic shoulder shrugs, which I hate because what is the use of shoulder shrugs? Where's the functional need to do this all the time? Unless you want to be the big guy in the bar. What's that? Yeah, I mean, for football players, wrestlers, absolutely that's important, right? But functionally, the majority of the time, it's not. So as a general rule, you know, you can see the arm positions here, middle fibers, lower fibers, right? That's sort of what you'll see. I'm sure Sarah will talk about that. You guys have Sarah for lab, right?
No, we have Michelle.
Oh, okay. All right. So yeah, there's this, you know, classic table thing that we do for strengthening as far as that goes. And you can do the same thing with cables if you need to, those sorts of things. Nasty muscle for trigger points. We've already done upper trapezius. Temple headaches, facial, temple, or jaw pain, pain behind the eye, can cause dizziness or vertigo, severe neck pain, stiff neck, can limit range of motion to the C-spine, intolerance to weight on your shoulders. Ladies, what could that be? Bra strap. Bra strap. In fact, I had the conversation with, as I said, one of your students, fellow students in a different semester, has a supraspinatus tear. So not sure how bad it is. And we had a discussion yesterday about maybe moving away from a traditional bra and going to a different style bra with like a crisscross pattern rather than all the weight on the shoulder, which may be causing some discomfort in her shoulder problems. Middle fibers, mid-back pain, headaches to the base of the skull, sometimes superficial burning close to the spine, refers aching pain to the top of the shoulder near the joints. And then lower, again, mid-back neck, upper shoulder, possible referral back of the shoulder blade, inside of the arm, into the ring and little fingers. Very similar to serratus posterior superior referral pattern, can cause headaches as well, and can refer a deep ache, diffuse tenderness over the top of the shoulder. Now, you guys are familiar now with strumming. Well, do you remember me telling about how you had to strum the different fiber directions to sort of work your way superficial to deep as you're working through, right? So now we're talking pretty much one of the most superficial muscles in the back. You know, everything we learned last semester with the erectors and all that kind of stuff, it's all well below this muscle. Rhomboids major. Rhomboids major, attachments between the root of the spine and the inferior angle of the scapula to the spinous processes of T2 to T5. So this is running down from the scapula up to the spine. Down from the scapula up to the spine. It functions, the muscle attaches from the spine medially to the scapula laterally, therefore it retracts the scapula. It also attaches from the spine superiorly to the scapula inferiorly, and this results in a superomedial movement towards the spine of the scapula. But fundamentally, it is a retractor. Innervation is C4, C5 of the dorsal scapular nerve. The strength test, and by the way, you guys have a new edition, and I haven't got that reflected in this book, so or in these slides, so I'm going to have to go and change them a little bit. So we've got rhomboids here, and the page is different. If anybody does have their book, it's actually 275, 275. So who wants to be next? Somebody, come on up. Do you have a T-shirt on under that?
Yeah.
Could you get down to your T-shirt? That'd make me very happy. Yeah, well, he's supposed to be the big hitter on the team, right? So I expect his rhomboids and rotators to be very powerful. Okay. down, thanks. All right. So we did trapezius. We had a sense of it. I touched you guys. Man, do you guys get treated ever? Holy moly. He was just as bad. Yeah, I know, but no. Like, that's nuts. When's the last time you got treated?
I went home for Christmas.
Wow, man. You should get it regularly. Okay, so. So, patient is prone. None on the part of the examiner is necessary for fixation. So, if whatever side we're doing is adduction, elevation, and downward rotation of the scapula. To obtain this position of the scapula and leverage for pressure in the test, the upper extremity is placed in the position that we see here. So, I'm going to bring his arm in tight here. Okay? I'm going to bring his shoulder down, and you're just going to just kind of hold yourself here. And I'm going to bring my hand into this position here. All right, so I'm going to pull him down, bring into the elbow, and then what I'm going to do, the movement or the pressure is, the examiner applies pressure with one hand in the posterior distal elbow in the direction of scapular abduction and upward rotation. The other hand applies pressure. So I am going to apply pressure here. I'm going to try to pull you out here, and you're going to hold me, okay? Yeah, just like that, all right? You can see the position. So down, and he's into this position here, and then we pull out accordingly here. Okay, do you feel it in here?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what you're doing is just, again, you're following the example of it. Now, if he was weak in this area, this is not a position for strengthening. It doesn't exactly work well for that. So, yeah, the chicken wing. Everybody's in the gym doing this, right? Like that Saturday night at a wedding. Okay. So it says here, weakness. The scapula abduction upwardly rotates. The strength of adduction and extension of the shoulders diminished by loss of rhomboid fixation of the scapula. Ordinary function of the upper extremity is less affected by loss of rhomboid strength than by loss of either trapezius or serratus anterior strength. I'll repeat. Ordinary function of the upper extremity is less affected with rhomboid weakness. Okay, you get a lot more effective of upper arm problems with trapezius weakness than with rhomboid weakness. Okay. So we can see here, it's the lower part here from the inferior angle up. And I haven't got all the exercises in that yet because we're going to do minor next because quite simply, and that's the one thing with that test, you're doing major and minor at the same time. Ultimately, they're hard to isolate between the two. So minor, where major arose from the root of the spine in the inferior angle, minor arises from the spinous processes of C7 to T1 and the inferior nuchal line to the root of the spine of the scapula. So coming more downward, out and downwards towards the scapula. This is a muscle that attaches from the spine medially to the scapula laterally. Therefore, of course, it retracts the scapula at the scapulothoracic joint. It also elevates the scapula and downward rotates the scapula as well, and also medially tilts the scapula. So depending on which fibers or how much the fibers use, it does have somewhat of an effect on the scapula depending on what position it's in and what kind of position the scapula needs to be in order to have the shoulder function properly. So medially tilts the scapula. How's that going to work? Yeah, you've got a lot of movement in this. So elevates the scapula, no problem. Downwardly rotates the scapula, no problem. And medially tilts. Okay, so it's this kind of medial tilt that occurs. Innervation, dorsal scapular nerve, C4, C5. Strength test is the same. These muscles cannot be done individually. A self-hug or reach, stretch, shoulder blade squeeze, and the PNF is our first one, which we'll do here in a second. So this one is quite popular to use. So is the self-hug. So everybody give yourself a hug. And go all the way across to the shoulders, and before you start to really pull those shoulders out, drop your shoulders down and then pull them forward. Everybody feel the stretch? Actually feels good, doesn't it? Yeah, but you got to drop those shoulders down and then pull. So you're trying to pull the scapula apart behind. You don't feel it? You might be fine. Possibly. You can see here that this is one of the common strengths routines for the rhomboids. Palm thumbs up moving forward. Also, seated row will bring them in as well. Trigger points here. Active trigger points and rhomboids tend to refer pain locally. It's usually presented as pain described by the client as mid-upper back pain, pain in the back of the shoulder. These are easy to find. This is where you start digging in for fiber direction and working your way through and depending on what you're looking for. Now for PNS stretching is page 33. What's important when you're looking at these stretches for PNF, you've got to get your patient in a position to be able to apply any of the PNF techniques, depending on which one you wish to use of the three, right? Yeah, 33. So you'll see the patient is on the table with the affected arm over the edge of the table so that it can drop down, and the stretch is being done with the therapist being able to, you know, lift the shoulder up to shorten or down to pull, depending on which way you're working. You know, up would be obviously to produce a contraction, then to, right, for contract, relax, then to pull accordingly. So for my purposes here, I don't go through the PNF test so much. It's just having a look at the position of the patient in the movement and understanding that, you know, A, knowing what the movement is, and B, putting the patient in the appropriate position to be able to perform the test that's required. Now, I know Michelle doesn't like this book because he uses type 1, type 2, and type 3, and we don't use those terms anymore, right? We use the ones that we talked about last semester. So. But the positions are good in the book. I think it does to some degree. Oh, that might be a mistake by me. Well, C7 would be the very tip of the inferior nuchal. Oh, I should probably shoot nuchal ligament. You're right. More than likely. You're right. That's a typo I've never caught before. This is a bit of an older slide. Yeah, not the line. Doesn't go up that high. Okay. My favorite, and possibly what will become yours, is levator scapula. This is a nasty little muscle. It causes all kinds of problems. Headaches, dysfunction, all sorts of things. It arises from the posterior tubercles of TVPs C3 and 4 and TVPs of C1, 2, and 4. If the posterior tubercles of C3 and 4 and the TVPs of 1, 2, and 4 to the medial border of the scapula from the superior angle to the root of the spine. So right from... I don't like this one. It's all broken apart. Wait from this point here on the scapula, and then posterior tubercles of C3 and C4, and TVPs of C1, C2, and C4. Now, how much time have you guys spent palpating TVPs of C-spine? Have you actually been able to pick them all out? Any of them? How many? What's that? No, it's not actually, because you likely haven't. It takes some time to get good at that, but I really challenge you to try to get used to that, so that you can get in and find, even on yourself to begin with, can you find 1, then 2, then 3, then 4? So hopefully I'll get a volunteer here who was willing to get a bit uncomfortable. So. When the cervical spine is fixed, this pulls the scapula superiorly, hence its name, levator scapulae, elevates the scapula. Its fibers cross the C-spine laterally, so it can also pull the C-spine ipsilaterally. This configuration allows for ipsilateral rotation. Now, if you guys have not palpated this yet, correct? Okay. So quite often, people palpate this through trapezius, which kind of makes sense, right? If you think of where the scapula is in relationship to it, and you're trying to find the superior angle of the scapula, then ultimately you would want to go through there. But there is a better way, and that's to go down in front of trapezius, down into the angle of the scapula that way. So you kind of, somebody just take a picture. Okay. Like, you can go down that way. So who wants to come up? Look at everybody afraid. I don't care. Are you wearing anything under that? A t-shirt or no? No? Yeah. No. Come on. Have a seat. If we were in the lab, I wouldn't care, but I know seating. Sitting. Yep. So if we think of trapezius comes and finds You can feel the anterior border of upper trapezius this way. You've also been taught to find a scapula this way, correct? Okay. Now, and I told you before, when you're palpating the scapula, when you're looking for your T-spine segments, you bring the hand back into anatomical position, right? I don't want to do that with this one. I want her to stay in this position because what that's done, it's elevated the superior angle up towards the top of trapezius. Okay, so just by literally doing this, I've now brought the spine, the superior angle, it's right there, right? Easy to find. Okay, very, very easy to find. And rolling right around that upper angle, that superior angle, I can do it. How's that feel? Is it sore or not too bad? It's sore, right? So if it's kind of, if she's got a scapula that's not moving well, this position, quite often I'll do it in prone, but we're not on a massage table. I'll then take my hand and I'll elevate the scapula even higher, and then I can get right in there to elevate her scapula. Yeah. Is that referring? Or just sore? Yeah. You can come and look. Yeah. So just follow my finger in, and with it pushed up. Come around. Put your hand on mine. Uh-huh. Follow my index finger. Follow it in. There's the superior angle right there.
Oh wow.
Easy to find, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
You
if you know, it hurts, doesn't it? I told you, it's a nasty muscle. It causes lots of problems. People hate it when I work on it. Yeah, easy enough to do. Okay, so if you bring it back here again, it's buried. I can't get at it when I put the hand back in the anatomical position. I can, but this just causes that rotation to occur. The superior angle comes up, and it's easier to palpate. Now, don't say anything to Michelle. Michelle shows you a different way, right? Because there are other ways to palpate it, but I just found this is much easier. So I'm gonna have you line supine for a moment. Head down that end, sorry. So if I'm looking at, from a treatment perspective, some of you might want to come around because you're over there and you can't see it. I said come around. Okay, so you can also come this way. So here is upper trapezius here. This is the anterior border of it. And I can come down around. So I'm going to follow here. And there's a little soft spot right there. So I follow the trapezius in here. And right at the, shall we say, the corner of upper trapezius and the C-spine, there's actually a soft spot right here. And I can go right in and find that angle right there. How's that feel?
Great.
Not great, right? Which, again, is it trigger point? Is it referring? Okay, doesn't have to, don't worry. So, we said tubercles of C3 and 4 and TVPs of 1, 2, and 4. So if we think of where we palpated C1, where did we palpate C1? Mastoid process, just anterior to it. If you can't find it, you rotate away, it's right there. So there's one, killer, eh?
Mm-hmm.
See, and then we're gonna come off. And we're just going to come right in to those right there. So I am pushing that hard. The one thing I want you to get used to is understanding if you can be specific. You don't have to work hard. She probably feels like I'm shoving my thumb all the way through and out the other side of her neck, but I am not. I'm being very specific. There's a TVP right there. Okay, so I'm on the very tip there, and it's killer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is 2, and then I'm going to come right into 3, right? And again, I'm only pushing that hard, okay? So this is why it's important to start doing your palpations and be a little more specific, understanding your anatomy. You're spending all the time to learn this. You might as well do it. Is it referring or just sore?
Just sore.
Yeah. Crazy, eh? And then the last one's right there. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay? And again, I'm not working hard. I'm barely pushing, but I'm being very, very, very specific. Now, I'm using my thumb, which is a bit gentler. If I want to be a bit more specific, then I'll use my index fingers. See, there's, I don't know if you guys have you guys been taught area of pressure is defined by the patient as being more or less pressure. So if I pushed with their neck, with my palm of my hand, how do you feel that?
Not bad.
Not bad. And then with a knuckle, yeah. And then with the flat of a finger, again, I'm pushing all the same weight, right? And it she will feel it. She'll perceive it as being much more specific and deep, depending on what I'm using when I'm approaching the tissue. I mean, you are out of it. Do you feel it?
In terms of what?
You're like this. So her right side is down and slightly rotated anteriorly. You guys haven't done any of this yet, have you? Have you done that with C1? What's that? No. So this is what I want you to try to work on, is that if you can find things, so you learned C1 last semester. It's not time yet for anything, but go back and see if you can find it, because I think this is your culprit. Yeah, do you feel you're out now? See where the difference of my fingers are? So you're this way and this way. Okay? So you're just going to work on that, right? Do you have headaches or problems anymore? Do you feel a snap?
Yeah.
Thank you. Dear God. So remember, it's not about, because, you know, people will say, Brian works deep. You feel a bit lightheaded? Yes?
No.
Does it feel looser?
Yeah.
Yeah? And see, I barely did anything and I didn't push hard, even though it felt hard. So be specific. Take all this anatomy that you're learning to your advantage when you're working with your partners and your patients eventually. But it's the nasty muscle. I work on it all the time, especially with people who are computer people, and they're sitting all the time in front of a computer. It's a brutal muscle. Strength test. So you want levator scap. You think levator. Levator is kind of the same test we did already. With it. So the same test that we did on rhomboids is basically brings levator in as well, although I've got a different one that I'll do here in a moment. So we can see here that, again, right on the tips of those TVPs, that's why you've got to get your palpatory skills down so you can find those transverse processes and start to individualize them, because then you can start really isolating. You talked about O and I, right? Okay, so if you're going to do O and I, you need to know where O and I are, right? So you've got to try to get into getting a feel for where those transverse processes are and how you can access them. Stretch is the look away, so you're smelling your armpit, right? I'm sure you've all know this stretch, correct? Right, it's pretty common stretch. Shoulder elevation with resistance will also help strengthen this muscle as well. But the majority of time that I've ever seen, this muscle is never weak. It's always too strong because of its need to kind of keep things from falling forward all the time when we sit and we do things. Trigger points. They lie just above the superior angle of the scapula, and the upper trigger points lie 1 to 3 inches above the lower trigger point. Both points lie deep to the upper trapezius, and both refer pain laterally to the shoulder and along the medial aspect of the shoulder blade. I have also found that they feel, sometimes the patient can feel it on the anterior shoulder when you get in there, as far as that goes. But as you know, with Samantha, you don't always have to have trigger points for it to be a problem. Has anybody here found trigger points yet? On their partner in lab. Always remember, if you want to find trigger points, you got to get in there. You know, I've met long-term therapists who said they've never found a trigger point, and that kind of disturbs me, because it tells me that, yeah, I have found people who've been massaging for 10 years who say, I've never found a trigger point. And I'm like, well, then you're not pushing hard enough, because you'll find them. And it's not that you're trying to be aggressively shoving your thumb 2 or 3 inches into your patient. But you do have to get deeply into the tissue. And Jen may have already talked to you about this. You guys ever had Jen? Yeah, Jen. Because Jen and I talk about it all the time, that we find far too often therapists these days are just not working deep enough. And that's one thing that will bring you patients if you get an effect change. So, again, if we look at upward rotators of the scapula, upper trapezius, serratus anterior, A, B, C. So upper rotators, A, upper part of trapezius, B, serratus anterior, C, lower part of trapezius. Downward rotation, rhomboids, levator scapula, and pectoralis minor, and we'll get to those muscles shortly. Take a break. I'll see you guys around 10:02. Okay. Sounds for a second like someone had cast a net or something. So we've already done 2 serratus muscles. We did serratus posterior superior, serratus posterior inferior. Remember, they're called serratus because the way they attach to the ribs, they look like a serrated knife. So this is very similar. Because of its attachments, those rib attachments look serrated. So it arises from the anterolateral surface of ribs 1 to 9 to the anterior surface of the entire medial surface of the scapula. So, again, if we think of where the scapula sits and where the chest wall is, now this is a muscle that comes around the chest wall from those attachments on the ribs, comes all the way around onto the anterior portion of the scapula. So it comes up and wraps around and then kind of onto the scapula. It doesn't continue on the rib cage. So because of that, the costal attachment is more anterior than the scapular attachment, which results in protraction of the scapula. This muscle is the punching muscle. So boxers, this is the muscle they strengthen. This is the muscle that drives that punch, that it protracts that scapula. So when you're looking at someone who's a boxer or a fighter, it's this muscle that they're working extensively to attempt to get strong. And you can see that right here on, anybody know who this is? Manny Pacquiao. So this right here is serratus anterior. That's why he had one of the deadliest punches in there, because he could drive so much power because he had such strong serratus anterior muscles. So, again, the costal attachment is more anterior than the scapular attachment, which results in protraction of the scapula used for pushing, punching, and reaching forward. It also causes the inferior angle of the scapula to swing anteriorly and superiorly, resulting in the glenoid fossa orienting upward. And we need this to accompany abduction and flexion, which allows the full range of abduction and flexion. So we have to have an understanding that this tight orientation of the glenoid fossa and the head of the humerus, we need the scapula to be able to move around to match that humeral head as much as possible so everything stays intact. It can elevate the scapula at the SC joint with the superior fibers. It can depress the scapula with inferior. Only upper fibers can elevate and only lower fibers can depress. It medially tilts the scapula at the SC joint and downwardly tilts the scapula at the scapulothoracic joint. The important about this one is its innervation, and it is innervated by the long thoracic nerve, the majority of which arises from C5 and partially from C6 and C7. I did talk about, I think, a little bit about this last semester. If there's weakness in long thoracic nerve, the patient has something called winged scapula, right? That the scapula can't be held. And maybe I talked about it this class, can't remember. But winged scapula means that the scapula cannot be held tight against the thoracic cage because this muscle is so weak. So we can see it here. It comes from the somewhat lateral aspect of the rib cage here in these ribs, coming all the way around, and we can see it attaching here. Now, from my perspective, what is different, I was always taught that it came all the way around, and the majority of it attached on the medial aspect of the anterior scapula. But Muscolino is saying that it actually attaches on the entire anterior surface of the scapula. So, I mean, it goes all the way around anyway, so it's quite conceivable that as it passes in that roundabout that it finds attachment on it as well. So remember, anterior lateral surfaces of ribs 1 to 9 to the anterior surface of the entire medial surface of the scapula. So as far as strength test goes, what do you think? Yeah, you can push, right? What else? So we can see here the push-up, but not the push-up that you think, the push-up where you're doing this. Yeah, so I'm not doing this, I'm just literally in the position doing this. I'm driving my up and down this way rather than, you know, doing the bent elbow push. Okay, so the stretch is quite simple, and I want everybody to jump up and try this to see how tight your serratus is or not. Find a flat wall and see if you can all do this. Flat against the wall, right out to elbows on the wall, and everything flat against the wall where you stand. This position here, right? See if you can get your shoulders against the wall and get your elbows. Yeah, you're fine. It'll just be the boys then, will it? Interesting. Usually one or two are kind of tight. I'm kind of tight because I had the shoulder surgery, so I don't function quite as well. It's also you're all young. That's why. Okay. If the client is unable to do that, then the next step is this way. Is if it's tight, it's just fists against the wall and then work on getting the elbows out towards the wall as well. To stretch it as well, you can do it this way. So client extends the arm to hold onto the back of the bench and rotates the body to the contralateral side, which results in contraction of the scapula, and you get the stretch that you need. Strength test is, is it 281? You already checked it? Okay. Oh, there it is. Who wants to do it? It's kind of a cool test. It's an easy one. Come on up. Supine, please. Okay, so the client abducts and upwardly rotates the scapula and holds the medial border of the scapula firmly against the rib cage. In addition, that's its action. Apologies. Test: abduction of the scapula, projecting the upper arm extremely anteriorly. So up like that. So you push up like this, making a fist, okay, and the test is literally me pushing down. Okay? Simple as that. What's that? Well, not if it's weak. Stay there for a sec. Might as well use it while you're here. So lie in sideline for me. So, because this is a muscle that comes, yeah, I know it's kind of uncomfortable. I apologize. You can do this if you want. Okay, and just relax your arm. Give me all your There we go. Okay. Just give me all your weight here. So we've got to understand that if I place my hand on this rib cage, right, I'm going to go over and around posteriorly, which will represent the muscle, right? And I hope you're not ticklish. Okay, good. Because sometimes what's that? Okay. So if I want to really get at this muscle, what I'll do is pull it forward. So the scapula comes this way, and that exposes much more of the anterior scapula in this position that I can get up at the muscle, right? So in this position, relax. In this position, the scapula is pulled back. It's accessible, but it's not much. So I'll just bring him forward, and then I can get underneath considerably. I'm down to my second knuckles to get in there. Now I'm staying with my palm face towards him to get at it. If I wanted to treat him, I'd come up this way and go in there. Is that sore? A little bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, relax. Not so bad now. Still sore. Yeah. So I'm able to get at, not all of it, obviously, thanks, but a fair majority of it, right? Okay. So another way of doing, you can, you know, these scapular push-ups, if the patient's not strong enough to do that, they could obviously do that against the wall, right? They could lean against the wall and do exactly the same thing. Trigger points here, serratus anterior, pain syndrome commonly presents with pain over the fifth to seventh ribs, along the midaxillary line, radiates to the anterior chest, the medial aspect of the arm, the medial border of the scapula, and occasionally upward toward the fourth and fifth digits, mimicking a radiculopathy, meaning like a disc herniation or something, it's irritating a nerve root. Now, I didn't get into the body of his serratus anterior, but a lot of you might find that you do have a lot of junk in this muscle. Yeah. So I'll get in there and poke around, and you'll be like, oh, geez, is that ever sore? Okay? It tends to be a bit of a sensitive muscle that way. Pectoralis minor. Anterior lateral surface of ribs 3 to 5 to the medial aspect of the coracoid process of the scapula. So minor runs deep to major. Like a finger kind of runs from the ribcage up to the coracoid process. This muscle attaches from the coracoid process posteriorly to the ribs anteriorly. Therefore, it pulls the scapula anteriorly, protraction at the SC joint. So because it runs back towards the coracoid process, it pulls the scapula anteriorly. It also attaches superiorly from the scapula to the ribs inferiorly, resulting in scapular depression. It can downwardly rotate the scapula, laterally tilt the scapula, and upwardly tilt the scapula. Those are not its primary actions. Its primary actions are protraction and scapular depression and downward rotation. If the scapula is fixed, then of course it pulls ribs 3 through 5 superiorly as sort of like a secondary muscle of inspiration. It helps elevate those ribs to some degree. Innervation, medial and lateral pectoral nerves, C5, C6, majorly, though, C7, C8, and T1. Okay? Yes, strength test for pec major. Got a page for that yet? Or pec minor, I mean. Sorry. It's got to be back here somewhere. Where are you, pec minor? Damn, someone. Here we go. Okay, who wants to be next on the table? The table of death. Come on, somebody. Pam, you picked an easy one. Supine for me, please. Okay, so because of its actions, fixation is basically because she's lying down, which is great. The test, forward thrust of the shoulder with the arm at the side. So subject must exert no downward pressure through the subject's hand to force. So basically what we're going to do is you're just going to lay here and I know it's a bit narrow. Just lift your shoulder up towards me and I'm just going to push down. And that's it. Okay? It's quite as simple as that as far as that goes. All right? Thank you. If we had in the lab, this is a fun palpation because you bury your hand right under pec major to get to it. Yeah, and it's quite easy to get at. So you literally come over the rib cage, up under pec major, and up into minor. So you can see it here. Major has been cut. You can see it arising here, coming up into the coracoid process. And they make it seem quite like a huge muscle, but it doesn't really feel that way once you get inside. It's maybe two fingers wide. That's about it. What's interesting about this muscle, it coincides along with scalenus anterior and medius. When we were talking about those last semester, I said that the subclavian artery in the brachial plexus passed through that triangle where those two muscles sort of found attachment. Well, as that brachial plexus and those arteries continue towards the arm, they pass under the coracoid process behind pectoralis minor. So if pectoralis minor is tight, it can cause numbness, tingling, and pain down the arm. So another possibility of cause of thoracic outlet syndrome is pec minor. So now you have the possibility of scalenus anterior and medius being a cause of thoracic outlet syndrome. But another cause could possibly be a tight pec minor, because as you can see here, it can exert pressure down on the two vessels and the brachial plexus, which could result in the problems. When you take your assessments course, you're going to take three tests that you do, which will differentiate structures that are the cause of the possibility of thoracic outlet syndrome. Obviously, one challenges scalenus anterior and medius, and the other test challenges pectoralis minor in the results of it, for example. Okay, so what you're doing is you're making those muscles contract to see if there's any symptomology in the hand, because quite often thoracic outlet syndrome, the symptoms tend to express in the hand as being the problem, numbness, tingling, or pins and needles, and that kind of stuff. Yes, depending on how significant the pressure was on it, yeah. And even loss of pulse. Yeah, two fingers ish or so. Yeah, you'll when you go into lab and palpate it, you'll be quite shocked at how small it actually is. And of course, it depends on the individual. And the interesting thing is, be careful when you get in there, because some people have really sore pec minors. It can be quite sensitive in that area. But you're going to be quite surprised to how far up you can get. You can get all three knuckles up into that chest wall underneath pectoralis major. Obviously, for females, you know, because you are significantly near breast tissue, right, when you're doing it, you don't have to expose the breast tissue in order to access pectoralis minor, but you do need to get relatively near that tissue to get to where you need to go. So you'll likely do, I'm assuming you'll do a drape that allows you to protect a woman's breast tissue while you do the palpation, and then you work your way upwards and in maintaining, safety in that area as far as that goes. So you're getting up and underneath and over. So what you see here, so we're going to go to, well, I've got major on here. So major, I'm going to do the stretch for major as well as minor here so you understand the difference. So if I wanted to do major, even though we haven't learned it yet, I would go into a door frame and I would step forward with my hand in this position. If I want to stretch minor, I go to here and then I stretch back. So I need that elevation to have that scapula come back, which, because remember it's a protractor, I will retract the scapula, which will bring a stretch onto pec minor. Okay? Okay. Yeah, a little bit, but it does. So, in you have to understand, you've got when you look at major versus minor, major attaches to the humerus and is an internal rotator. Minor attaches to the coracoid process of the scapula and is a protractor. So, if you try to do minor from here, you're not going to be able to because you actually are affecting the humerus. So by getting here up to here and stepping back, you're actually forcing the scapula back, which brings the stretch onto minor. Okay. Push-ups will work just fine, any kind of push-ups. And to some degree, lower flies will help with minor as well. Trigger points. Now, this is why, again, a muscle you need to consider is one is the thoracic outlet part. The second is trigger points here tend to produce pectoralis minor syndrome, which results in neurologic or vascular symptoms in the upper extremity, thoracic outlet syndrome. So trigger points in here can be the cause for TOS as a result of those trigger points keeping the muscle tight and putting pressure on the structures. Can cause a rounded shoulder posture, restriction, retraction of the scapula, deep pain in the interior shoulder with possibly referral to chest wall and the palmar surfaces of digits 3 to 5. Ladies, this is most popular in you. Why? Have I talked to you about breast posture? Right? So this is going to cause pectoralis minor to shorten and be a problem. So having to get those shoulders back and open, right, you're going to feel exposed, but that's what needs to happen to get pectoralis minor to open up and stretch out. Subclavius, just a crappy little muscle. It's not really that important, really. Oh, by the way, I learned something the other day. A rib steak, a ribeye? Do you know how there's one little thin, there's a big meaty part and there's a little thin piece? Do you know what that little thin piece is? Spinalis. I had no idea. I didn't realize that. There was a chef that was doing it and he said, like, this is the spinalis. And I'm like, oh, isn't that cool? Yeah, so now you got something new to add to gross everybody out when you go to a barbecue in the summertime. All right, subclavius. What's that? Yeah, it's a cry. Yeah, the ribeye is a prime rib cut. My favorite. So subclavius runs from the first rib at the junction with its costal cartilage to the middle one third of the inferior surface of the clavicle. So this tiny little muscle that sits right up here, just underneath the clavicle. When the first rib is fixed, it pulls the clavicle inferiorly at the sternoclavicular joint. The clavicular attachment is slightly posterior, so it does pull the clavicle anteriorly to some degree. It also results in downward rotation of the clavicle. If the clavicle is fixed, it does help elevate the first rib, but really it is a minor functioning muscle at the best of times. It's quite small and quite tiny. It does have innervation from the brachial plexus C5, C6. There is no test. To stretch it is the reach back. So just literally reaching back like this will, because it's bringing the clavicle back and out, right? So it is going to put a stretch on it. Again, think of the clavicles getting farther away from the attachment, so subclavius is going to get stretched to some degree. It's the same. Yeah, SC would be sternoclavicular joint. SCC joint is the scapulothoracic joint. To strengthen it, lie on the floor with two kettlebells next. I did find this. I went CrossFit. I had no idea there was a way to strengthen this. I hadn't even thought about it before. So they say here, lie on the floor with two kettlebells next to the shoulders. Position one in place on the chest, and then the other one. Make sure to grip the kettlebells using their handle and with the palms facing forward. Extend both arms so the kettlebells are held above the chest. Lower one of the kettlebells by bringing it to the chest and turning the wrist in the direction of the kettlebell that's locked out. Raise the kettlebell and repeat the opposite side. So they claim that this will do this muscle. But you'll still get pec minor and pec major involved as well with it, as far as that goes.
Could it, like a pace, like, did you have problems if
Well, yeah. So if it was tight, it would prevent some clavicular elevation, which is required in abduction. So, you might want to consider getting in there to some degree to see if you can find it. Do you have it there, Samantha? Is it even in the in that atlas? That not many atlases actually have it, so. There it is. Yeah. Okay. See, it's quite tiny. What are you using there? I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't know they were still making it. I was. I should ask a couple of you if you're willing to come to see the semester ones and tell them how great and wonderful I am and how easy the course is, and give them some insight as to, for example, what kind of programs you're using to help your studying and all that kind of stuff. To let them know that, because last week was their first week, and I won't say who, but so their first class was on Monday, and on Wednesday afternoon, I had a girl that was crying because she was overwhelmed and there was too much information. Yeah. Yeah, within 2 days. And I'm like, all we took was medial lateral, posterior superior, proximal distal, so. They'll survive. You guys survive. They'll survive. Okay. Trigger points can also produce this costoclavicular syndrome, which can be cause some neurological dysfunction and cause rounded shoulder. And it does refer where we saw here, right? It went to this side of four. 5, 4, and 3, we can see here it goes to 1, 2, and 3. Just a slight variation in the digits. It can. So it's a great one. We're going to talk a lot more about that when we get into the forearm, because the way the forearm is built, there's actually a foramen that the nerve travels through that are the tendons of a couple of muscles in the forearm that can definitely mimic carpal tunnel syndrome or ulnar nerve impingement, that kind of stuff, which really isn't at all happening. It's actually a trigger point in the muscle that's causing the tendon to be tight and compress the nerve much more proximally up at the elbow. We'll get into that when we get into the forearm. Oops, what did I do here? Is that it? That the last slide? Oh, good. Okay. All right. What was the next one on the agenda? So I can tell you, being sick, I did watch a lot of movies. And I watched Gran Turismo. Anybody watched it? I was shocked. I had no idea that happened. I thought it was really cool. Yeah, it's a true story. Gran Turismo. Yeah, they took the top 10 video racers in the world and trained them, and one won and actually raced real cars professionally. I had no idea that happened. It was pretty neat. That crash was incredible when he took air. Okay. Now, I can tell you this much too. When I was sick for 2 days trying to watch TV, Rogers went down both days for 4.5 hours. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, what do you do? Sleep. Okay, so next set and related to the shoulder are the following muscles. So the first is called the deltoid. I'm sure you've heard this many times. You probably maybe palpated it initially in your first lab. So this is a three-headed muscle. It arises from the the lateral one third of the clavicle, the acromion process, and the spine of the scapula. So again, you take this with your hand and you put it all the way around, spine of the scapula, acromion, and clavicle, so like a horseshoe shape, all the way around the shoulder. So you can see it here. Let's see if we've got a good picture here. So you can see it here in the front where it's attached onto the clavicle and a bit of the acromion and continues all the way around and down the spine of the scapula. You can kind of see it here in the cadaver as well. And quite a large muscle for the arm, and it sort of covers a fairly broad area in the arm itself. So the lateral one third of the clavicle, acromion process, and spine of the scapula to the deltoid tuberosity of the humerus. How many people found the deltoid tuberosity heart palpation? It's a bugger, eh? Like, it's not really this like big thing sticking back at you, right? It's you know, you follow that deltoid down and you go, I'm not feeling a tuberosity, but I know where yeah, where they all come together, right? But down a little bit further even more, because there's a bit of a tendinous part there. But still, there are many individuals I really struggle trying to find that tuberosity. It's, as I said, it's not one that really sticks out. Some people it might, but not so much. You'll be the one that you get in your OP for your license. Trust me. Trust me. There's always that one that you just didn't study, right? And that's the one you're going to get in your OP, right? Your OSCE and your... So, because it wraps all the way around anterior, lateral, and posterior, then you have fibers that relate anteriorly, fibers medially, and fibers posteriorly. So there are various actions that occur because of this configuration. Now, they all come to a point on the lateral aspect of the humerus. Okay, so anterior to lateral, lateral to lateral, posterior to lateral. So this muscle crosses over the top of the GH joint on the lateral side, which results in abduction. So you've got over the top, down the front, or down the side. So in abduction, it's the middle fibers that do most of the work. Okay? So in abduction, it's mostly the middle fibers, but the anterior and posterior, if they're all functioning at the same time, will provide support and work in abduction. The anterior head crosses the GH joint anteriorly, which therefore results in flexion because it's reaching back to the deltoid tuberosity. It's pulling into flexion. Everybody follow me so far? Well, because the posterior head crosses the GH joint posteriorly, so it's coming from back here to here, what does it do? Pulls into extension. So middle, anterior, posterior. Okay? It wraps around the anterior humerus to reach the tuberosity, which results in medial rotation of the humerus, and at 90 degrees, this head also horizontally adducts. So the anterior head does cross from front to lateral, so therefore it's a flexor. But because it wraps around to get to the deltoid tuberosity, does everybody understand that? Because it's coming around and wraps around, it is a medial rotator. Now, what happens to the relationship of the deltoid tuberosity to the anterior attachments when I go into 90 degrees of abduction? Where are my arms in relationship to the fiber direction at 90 degrees of abduction? So let's start again. Actually, come on up. Let me use you. Just it might be easier for you to, if I put my hands on you. Okay, so let's think about this. We've got fibers, probably better to do it this way. So we've got fibers that are coming anteriorly to the deltoid tuberosity, posteriorly to the deltoid tuberosity, and laterally to the deltoid tuberosity. So we said that because anterior comes down here, it's a flexor. But what we need to understand is the anterior comes down and wraps around like this, right? So therefore, it is a medial rotator. So if the fiber direction, I'm just going to do it this way, if the fiber direction of anterior deltoid is here, what's just happened in 90 degrees of abduction? Where are the fibers? See the change in the fibers? So they're this way in the anatomical position, and they just did what in 90 degrees of abduction? So therefore, 90 degrees anterior head is a horizontal adductor. Because you see the fibers this way, right? So it pulls the arm like this because you've changed. The arm is now running parallel to the fiber direction. So internal rotator this way, horizontal adductor this way. Everybody sees that? Okay, thanks. Okay. The posterior head crosses the DH joint posteriorly, which results in extension. The posterior head also wraps around the posterior humerus to reach the tuberosity, which results in lateral rotation. And in 90 degrees abduction, it does what? It horizontally abducts. Pretty functional muscle, eh? So this, and this. Yeah, exactly. Da na 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 na. Yep. Actually, trust me, you guys are going to be doing the dermatome dance in a couple of semesters. The dermatome dance. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the muscle, the neural dermatomes. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah. They're doing it all, trust me. But do you understand that? This muscle does a lot, right? It's a highly important muscle to what the shoulder does. So flexion, extension, abduction, right? Not adduction, though. Abduction. And then internal, external, horizontal AD, horizontal AB. Okay? Innervation of the axillary nerve, C5, C6. It's kind of an important one. It's interesting. So C5 is one of those areas of the cervical spine that's kind of vulnerable. It tends to get kind of worn out and a bit of damage to the nerve root. So what's really nice is because it's, as you can see, it's bold. If I think you have a nerve impingement in C5, all I have to do is resist it abduction. And if it's weak, there's a good chance. Right? Just resisted abduction will give me a sense of whether or not there's C5 weakness. The other thing is from a sensory point of view, if the sensory neuron for C5 is damaged, you get what's called a military patch. You know how in the military your sergeants and you know you wear your stripes are all here? Well, it's called a military patch because if the sensory nerve is damaged, you get this circular area over the deltoid that gets numb. Doesn't function properly. Again, you'll learn that in assessments, but C5 is an easy one, okay? Just resist that and see what happens. Strength tests. Obviously, you could do any one of those in terms of actions in any of those heads. I just want to see. Yeah, so there you go. Kendall, basically, because it uses all three heads, she first does all three heads and just resisted abduction, right? And then to do anterior deltoid, the shoulder abduction in slight flexion. So ultimately, this is the test middle head. Resisted abduction here is anterior head. And going back here, we test a bit more posterior head. Makes sense, right? If you think about it, right? You're resisting in this direction. Does that confuse everybody, or does that everybody understand that? When you when you are trying to muscle test, it's what you're doing to the fibers that become important. So in anterior deltoid, if I do the test, the shoulder abduction in slight flexion and slight external rotation. Does that make more sense to you? Right? Because that's what I'm doing to that muscle is I'm actually putting some length on it, and then I'm testing it. By putting length on the muscle I want to test, or the fibers I want to test in the case of deltoid, if I'm doing anterior and I'm putting some length in the test on the anterior, what's happening with the posterior? They're getting short, so they can't function as much. So you isolate the fibers that you're after by doing that. So by putting some length on the anterior fibers, you're more likely to involve them in the resistance. And because the posteriors are kind of flabby, they're not going to work as much, so you're going to get a better sense of anterior fibers. Okay? And you'll learn that as you go along, is that, you know, you put a bit of length in the muscle you want to test, especially if everybody's closely related to each other and you're trying to isolate. You try to get those other muscles that are related soft out of the way, some tension in the one that you want to test, and that's how it works. PNF, again, because you don't have the books, I'll just say it's basically kind of the same position. You know, they're sitting and you're resisting appropriately in the position. So you can see here, again, it surrounds the whole area down to the deltoid tuberosity. Even in a cadaver, it's quite a large-looking muscle on the shoulder. You know, that's why its nickname is kind of like the shoulder cap, right? Because it does cap over the shoulder. And as you can see, it does a lot of stuff with the shoulder joint itself. So stretching it, ultimately, you know, you can attempt to try to do the whole thing, but it's better to do some isolation. So the full one is just the quite the simple, everybody does this in class, right? You know, when you go to a fitness class, right? Everybody does this, you know. Okay, right, that'll do the full thing. Anterior, obviously, but posterior is kind of cool. You just pull it across through the back and work with it. Now, strengthening. This is an important muscle that in some cases gets overworked. Let's do bench press, for example. How far is that bar supposed to go down? What's that? The bar should never touch your chest. If the bar touches your chest, you've gone too far. Your upper arm should be parallel to the floor. Oh, you're one of those cheaters. You go like this when you're rich. I'm kidding. Yeah. So the idea is, Logan used a really appropriate term. You hear this all the time in the gym. You want to work the full range of the muscle, right? You hear that all the time, which is completely correct. The problem is, when you look at exercises that people do, such as the bench press, they think the full range of the muscle that you're doing, pectoralis major, is bar to the all the way to the chest and back up again, which is completely incorrect. You've gone beyond the full range of pectoralis major, and when the bar gets down to the chest wall, to get back to this point, guess what you're using? Anterior deltoids. So if you've got a massive muscle that you're benching 215 pounds, good luck for me, or I think the max I ever did was 210, and that was like, anyways. So pecs can do that. You get too low, and now I have to initiate anterior deltoid, tiny little pair, to initiate back up to here. What's the major problem you always hear in the gym from people? Oh, my anterior shoulder just killing me all the time. Okay? So the reality is, from a safe perspective, it's just parallel to the floor till you feel a stretch in major, and then back up again, which is quite contrary to what you see with the machines that you use and all those sorts of things, right? Right? The other thing is, anterior deltoids is way overworked compared to posterior. The other major problem that happens in the gym, everybody's anterior deltoids are always getting overworked and nobody works back enough, right? So, you know, these, I have a couple of tube exercises that are killer that work really well. And it works the shoulder and also posterior deltoids. Anybody here do T's, V's, and I's? What's that? T's, V's, and I's. So take a surgical tube with handles on it, and they got them at the gym, and clip it onto something that's at your shoulder width or just a bit higher. Okay, stand back with the tube. T's, V's, and I's is one set. You do it with dumbbells? How do you do it with dumbbells? If you do this with a dumbbell, you're not getting any resistance on what you're after. If you do this way, you are, right? Your resistance in this way. Yeah, so T's, V's, and I's. You try that in the gym, you'll be shocked, especially for volleyball. Yeah. There's a phenomenal exercise physiologist who created this shoulder routine, and you should maybe start doing it. Lying on the floor, okay, on the floor, and taking your hands in the air and doing these and then these and just run through a whole routine. You'd be shocked. Your shoulders will be burned out in a heartbeat.
What's the difference between like having your hands like this when you're doing it and your hands like this?
Your position is different in terms of what muscle that you're doing. Remember, if I want to work a muscle, I want a bit of tension in it. So if I'm in this position, okay, because that's horizontal abduction, what am I working? Posterior fibers of deltoid. If I do this, now what am I working? Okay, but I'm still pulling this way. I'm changing the fiber direction. So I've changed what's working. I'm likely going to work rhomboids and middle trapezius. Okay, give the thumbs up. Okay, it gets complicated, but once you figure it out, once you know what's going on, you're going to be like me. You're going to go into the gym and go, holy freaking God, I can't believe what I'm seeing, right? People are wasting so much time and energy, right, on things that they shouldn't be doing. It just drives me crazy. And I just go, I cringe at all. Well, actually, I used to cringe, but then I went, well, I'll just pull my card out and just start handing my card out to everybody in the gym to keep busy, right? Yeah. Do you have a question? Oh, you had your question.
Yeah, so, like, would you, like, recommend then if you want, like,
you know, yeah. Yeah, just work them in, but I'll try to find the routine for you because I think it'll probably help the shoulder a lot. But again, this is the fundamental problem that we see with people. Again, anterior deltoid gets used all the time and posterior doesn't. Not enough time is spent. And when people do back routines, they still don't do this. They do latissimus pull-downs. They do like Roman curls, which I like. I think it's really good for lumbar spine. Yeah, resisted back extensions are great. Although that in mind, you have to be careful of fitness level because if you load them too much, right? But good mornings and deadlifts, can't stand them. They're just because they're an accident waiting to happen. I used to have a slide. I have to show you a slide. I have a slide I got from Matt, who actually runs the health and fitness promotion course. And it's a piece of research where they went in and they actually measured the stresses on the L5 disc during deadlifts. If they're done even slightly off, yeah, your disc just goes. So imagine doing it lots of times. Yeah, you have to be at a very high level to do them. Yeah, okay. But there's lots of other ways. What are you using them for? Hamstrings? Oh, do you? And what do you do deadlifts for? Core?
I don't know.
No? Okay. Because over the last number of years, they seem to have become the exercise. You know, people will only join a gym that has bar cages because, you know, I see people doing squats too, you know, even with light weight, and they're like, and I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah, It's crazy. Well, you guys, though, you're really lucky. You're actually getting a REM-X course, There was never, there hasn't been a REMEX course for years. So next semester, you guys are getting a REMEX course. Remedial exercise. So understand that if you take health and fitness promotion, fundamentally, legally, you can only train apparently healthy individuals. Because you're a massage therapist and you're learning remedial exercise, you actually learn exercise prescription for unhealthy people. I think KINS can do unhealthy people in your scope of practice, right? Like you can do people with rheumatoid arthritis, heart disease, all that kind of stuff, right? Where people who come out of health and fitness promotion really can't do that, but we can as well. So you're going to learn how to exercise people who are relatively compromised from musculoskeletal conditions and all those sorts of things as far as that goes. Trigger points here, basically posterior deltoid, weakness when performing shoulder abduction, pain in the posterior head, TPs and anterior deltoid produces weakness in shoulder abduction or flexion of the arm, pain in the anterior head, and what have we got here? Posterior deltoid. Okay, so they're pretty straightforward. Any trigger points in the deltoids tend to stay in the deltoids. Last muscle before we go. Coracobrachialis. The name tells you exactly where it is. Coracoid process to the arm. Okay, so the apex of the coracoid process of the scapula to the middle one-third of the medial shaft of the humerus. So you're now being introduced to your first muscle that is related to the shoulder that crosses straight across to the upper arm bone, all right? And this muscle arises right on the tip of the coracoid process. This muscle crosses the glenohumeral joint anteriorly with the fibers running vertically in the sagittal plane, okay? This results in flexion of the upper arm of the GH joint. Now, if you remember your anatomy, that should make absolutely no sense to you whatsoever. I'm surprised no one's got confused by that. Tip of the coracoid process to the, what do we say here? Middle one-third of the shaft of the humerus. So remember that it sits this way, and it's like that. So everybody sees the coracoid process and the humerus, right? So we're saying crosses the GH joint anteriorly with fibers running vertically in the sagittal plane. Does that make sense? It's going to run from the tip of the coracoid process down to the humerus, correct? Pretty vertical, I would say, yes. Yeah, kind of. See that? Yeah. Okay. This results in flexion of the upper arm of the GH joint. Yes? Because it's running from here down to here. Flexion, correct? Everybody can see that? Okay. All right. Also crosses the GH joint medially with fibers running vertically in the frontal plane. Therefore, adducts the arm at the GH joint. So because of its configuration down to here, it flexes, which if I put my fingers kind of where it attaches, it flexes. Does that make sense? Because when you look at it this way, it also adducts. So if the arm is here, it's going to adduct towards, back towards. Does everybody see that? Right? Okay. And it's a strong horizontal flexor adductor of the arm at the GH joint. So at 90 degrees, guess what it does? Right? Same as anterior deltoid, because what's happened to the fibers? They've gotten parallel to the coracoid process, right? It's very powerful. So when you're doing these in the gym, flies, guess what you're mainly working? This, not pectoralis major. You are working pectoralis major, don't get me wrong, but you're actually, this is the prime horizontal adductor of the upper arm. So these actually work coracobrachialis. Yeah, you do it lower or these will work. Okay, but when you do this into external rotation, then, yeah, the pad things, because what you're doing is I put a stretch on pectoralis major in that way, then I can isolate pectoralis major a bit better. Okay. innervation, musculocutaneous nerve, C5, C6, C7. Strength test is this. Sending the patient up into 90 degrees of abduction, applying resistance into horizontal abduction, and they're resisting. Make sense? Because it's a horizontal adductor, I'm going to push into abduction, and they're going to resist. Right? Make sense? Okay. So we can see here, we've got, you can see how it's attached here at the tip, down to the clavicle, or down to the humerus. We see it here with deltoid removed, right? And we can see how it lies behind biceps brachii. So it's just behind biceps brachii in its attachment. So we can stretch it to some degree by doing this, bringing it across. This is the better way to stretch it here. So the hand is placed on the wall and the patient turns to do it. You can do it a little bit, they say, with anterior raises. Myself, if I wanted to, I would suggest that when you do flies, you know, depending on where you put your hands here and do end-to-end dumbbell flies, you'd work more coracobrachialis, whereas when you came out a little bit and turned, you're using more pectoralis major. Are you starting to understand? When you place stress on a muscle fiber, you isolate it more one than the other. So by, even in flies, so by simply this position versus this position, I've completely changed what muscle I want to isolate when I'm doing it. So for those of you who work out, it may fundamentally change your whole routine to some degree in terms of how you isolate a bit better. It might not. You're right. It might not, but you might. Wide hand push-up will also work coracobrachialis as well. Trigger points. Severe pain to the anterior shoulder, triceps region, posterior forearm, and dorsal surface of the hand. It's often incorrectly assessed as carpal tunnel syndrome, subdeltoid subacromial bursitis, acromioclavicular joint arthritis, supraspinatus tendonitis, or C5, C6, or C7 nerve compression. Who knows more about trigger points than us? Not many. So guess what the family physician is going to do? They're going to decide one of these diagnoses and not be able to figure out why the patient isn't getting better. And in the last ditch effort, they're going to come to you, and you studied really hard when you were at school, and you remembered that a trigger point in coracobrachialis can mimic some of these things, and you become the guru because you stick your finger in there, find a trigger point, and they get better. And that stuff happens all the time. It's the reason why you need to know all this stuff, because it's going to show up at some point in some way, and you're going to fix someone's life. Trust me. You really are. All right. See you guys next week. Now, Michelle's going to be mad because I probably didn't get through as much as she wanted me to. Just tell her I was really sick and I didn't feel like moving fast. She did say you guys did a phenomenal job in your presentations on palpations. You guys presented palpations, right? Yeah. It's because I already showed you how to do them. So, what's your prediction?